Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the works of Thomas Harris. I'm Cooper, and with me I have...
Hi, it's Miko.
And this is Ophelia.
And we're joined today by Kate Kulczyk from the This Is Our Design podcast, as well as Televerse and Sound On Sight and AV Club. So welcome, Kate.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And we're here for Season 2. Mm-hmm. And since Season 2 is a Japanese theme, we are going all out in theme wine. So, ladies, what do we have here tonight?
Okay. We have a plum wine that is Hakutsuru. And we're also drinking a sake, which is actually deemed a lightly sweet sake, and it's a Momokawa. So Junmai Jingo Craft Sake.
See, I wasn't even going to try.
No. Wasn't even going to try. That's all you.
And tonight's episode is?
Kaisuke.
Okay, and there's been some debate about whether the show even pronounces it correctly.
Well, the Americans have a tendency to pronounce every single syllable.
The Americans.
The Americans, I'm sorry. So it is Kaiseki, but sometimes it's like I'm used to just sort of pronouncing it in a different way. So I am saying Kaiseki, but it's just closer.
Quicker. Actually. It's actually quicker.
Yeah.
So, Kate, your podcast was what got me excited about doing a Hannibal podcast, and it was really cool to find that and then listen to it in that horrible period that comes right after Friday night, where you've already watched the episode, and then you have nothing to do for a week other than think about the episode.
That awful long week.
That we are reinforcing with Miko, because we are watching an episode a week, pretty much. But we did go really quick back-to-back from the finale to this episode. So tell us about your podcast.
Well, This Is Our Design is the podcast I co-host with Sean Coletti over at Sound On Sight. That's just about Hannibal. And we started with Season 2. And I was so glad to do the podcast because I was in that same position where I would watch it on Friday and be freaking out. And I would know three people, maybe.
No one watches Hannibal.
No one watches Hannibal. Of course, lots of people watch online. And there's a huge community that you guys are well aware of. The Hannibals are awesome. But in realsies, it was just basically me and my sister freaking out and me needing someone to talk to. And so when Sean said he wanted to do a Hannibal podcast, I was, pick me, yay, me, please. I can talk for hours, and we have. And so then we finished up Season 2 and got to that finale, which I will not say anything about because I know you haven't seen it, Miko.
Except that it may be perhaps the greatest hour of television.
I'm allowed to say that? Oh, yeah, I loved it.
Because that's all I'm saying to her. Oh, yeah. I just keep telling her how this is perhaps the greatest season of television, and that is perhaps the greatest hour of television.
They don't try to veil it so much that they don't try to, like, sway me with, oh, it's fantastic. Okay. No, they're not going, no, we're not going to let you know how we feel about it.
No.
So that you can develop. No, they're pretty clear about what is fantastic and what is,
We just leave the details out.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like that and Ozymandias and, like, those are the two. But anyway, so, of course, after that finale, it was like, we don't want to be done. So there's no more show. What can we do? And this summer, we've gone back and looked at Season 1. Mm-hmm. And so those are still actually being released at the time that we're recording this. Mm-hmm. We've just finished recording it, though. So it was great to be able to, finish our deep dive into Season 1. Mm-hmm. Deep dive. And then rewatch this one. And, because there's already a This Is Our Design podcast with me giving my thoughts about this episode.
Yes.
But I hadn't just rewatched Season 1, and I hadn't seen Season 2, and so I had a very different... I still liked it, and there's still a lot to talk about, but I hope I won't repeat myself too much.
Yeah, you repeat yourself all you want. And then all the listeners should go and listen to This Is Our Design. Mm-hmm. So I maybe gave you 10... 15 listeners just now.
Oh, hey, you know what? That would be a delightful bump in our ratings. We don't really know our numbers that well, but
I'll tell you, our circulation, it's a very small but devoted group.
This is the illustrious like world of podcasting. Yeah,
the illustrious world of podcasting about a show that really nobody no one is watching. But everyone who is loves it more than anything ever.
And rightly so.
And rightly so, indeed. Well, let's dive into the episode. Tonight we're directed by Tim Hunter, who is directed before. There's a lot of moving around over here. He is responsible for Fromage, which was our Tobias and Franklin episode in season one, and written by Steve Lightfoot and Brian Fuller. And Steve Lightfoot was a guy who, when I noticed his name in the season one credits, it's like, he writes a lot in season two. He basically becomes right-hand man for Brian Fuller. And what I like is that the selection of writers becomes this family of writers. You know, there's no real one-offs in season two. And that really, I think, is one of the things that directly leads to the consistency of the season. Because one of our biggest critiques of season one was the killer of the week stuff felt all over the map. Mm-hmm. And because of that, the season was rather inconsistent here and there. And so, yeah, in fairness of not overselling, season two is far more consistent. So we open with a flash forward. And yes. I'm going to get Miko's feelings about this right away.
I have to say, I was like, Mass and Lawrence Fishburne are freaking badass.
Yes.
we already knew that Lawrence Fishburne was badass. We've seen him do that in the past. So he's still got it.
And we've seen Mass's moves earlier in the season, too.
A little more downplayed than here. He really goes full out.
Yeah.
In this one. But it's true. It's like, it's not thoroughly surprising because he has kind of shown this before. But I wasn't expecting this, like, this like showdown. I mean, this was like, you know, the two gunslingers meeting.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the middle of town, and that moment, that tense moment where you feel that they're kind of flexing their fingers and they're giving each other the eye, and you know when it was happening, because I knew nothing about it. No one had given any of that away.
Let's just all stop and appreciate how hard that must have been for Ophelia.
Yes.
That we managed to get her to season two spoiler-free.
Spoiler-free, exactly.
That didn't even happen for viewers, necessarily, who watched it live.
Brian Fuller is just the...
Yeah,
it's like, let me tell you what I'm going to do, because it's awesome.
The scene was released ahead as like
a teaser.
And so I hadn't seen it, and so I had the same experience. Yeah. It's a wonderful first-time viewing experience.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of the listeners did not have that, because they were like, oh, sneak peek, awesome.
Oh, yeah, and I tried not to do any of that. Even though I knew it was out there, I completely tried not, don't look, avert your eyes. And so it was fresh for me. And I had no idea when they're giving each other those looks.
Yeah.
And it's all in slow motion, and you have the reflections and everything, that they're about to throw down, like, serious. You know, the knife and the way they wrap the... It's like two people who expertly have trained all their lives to do this are now clashing in a most epic way. But it's like they did all this, and they choke them out, and they do the stabbing, and then we go back 12 months.
Yeah, 12 months.
And I was like, so we're going to spend an entire season before I get to find out what the hell happens at the end of the season.
And, you know, that's Alfred Hitchcock's old thing. The way to suspense is you show the bomb under the table, and then you have guys just talking about baseball for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Because that is the most intense thing ever. And so to lead with this...
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering at that point, it's like, okay, did Jack find something out? Are we going to find out this episode? What the hell is going to...
Yeah.
Did Jack find the wound man somewhere?
Right.
Because that's how he gets caught in the books. Mm-hmm. Which is how he gets caught in the books.
In the books.
You read Red Dragon.
No, though. I've read nothing, but being familiar... Oh, well, I'm... being familiar with the show and having a podcast about it. Mm. Yeah, when they give that moment to Miriam last
in season one. That's what I was going to say. They gave that away.
Yeah.
Yes,
they did give that away. Because when she pulled that out, I was like, that's all Red Dragon. That's exactly. Yeah. And that was, I think we discussed in that episode, that's when we started to really realize how basically they're choosing Red Dragon as sort of pieces of a recipe.
Yeah.
They're just ingredients. They're not giving you the entire thing as it's intended. We're not doing Red Dragon the book. We're taking,
it's the Iron Chef version.
Exactly.
Of Red Dragon.
I'm going to give you all
here are some
this
ingredients,
dialogue.
And then your mystery ingredient is comedy.
Is comedy.
So, I really like that we opened with cutting meat.
Mm-hmm.
Like really close in.
Red
beef. Yeah, red meat.
Well, that close-up is so close you can't tell
like
exactly
what
he's
like a Kobe beef slice. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of Kobe beef when
yeah,
I saw that.
Yeah, because that marbled,
like,
yeah.
And of course, we're in the Japanese.
Did you notice Hannibal's weapons are a pepper grinder and an apron and a knife?
Yes.
Hannibal is fighting with, as a chef.
As a chef.
He is fighting.
Well, and he is in his kitchen.
Yeah, that's very true.
The knife that he has, I just wanted to point out, is one of the, like, super high grade, where the blade goes all the way through to the handle.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm a little bit of a foodie, so I know these things.
A little bit.
So, the knife that he uses in this scene is, like, one of the top knives you can have for slicing sushi, specifically.
Yeah.
And then, of course, this is with the Japanese theme, so I just wanted to throw that in there, that it's not just a kitchen knife. This is, like, one of those $300-$400 knives that are made out of, like, the same kind of steel that a katana would be made out of. It is,
which is very
serious.
Hannibal.
It is very Hannibal.
It is Hannibal,
In the books, they bring that up, especially now that I'm in Hannibal. It's that whole thing. He goes for specific, very specific instruments and very specific cooking utensils, and he will go anywhere to find specific, like, carbon steel, silverware, things like that. He has like a thing,
So
I could see him having probably the most expensive knife ever to do all that.
Well, and I love that at first when I watched it when it was airing, I was like, oh, look, we open on meat, and he's cutting, he's cooking, whatever. When I watched it this time, it's, like you said, it's that super close-up, and it's very red.
Very
and
red.
They're also, of course, about to tenderize the crap out of each other.
I'm surprised the tenderizing mallet did not come into play. Because that's the most weaponized item,
Oh, yeah.
Especially the kinds of, like, the spikes,
Big steel kind.
Yeah. And then, of course, Hannibal's crisp white shirt ends up bloodied, matching the meat. And then we cut to the white of the fish, and Hannibal's in this pristine, gorgeous, bright white or silvery, but ivory, not ivory, but very much, very white, very, like, slightly shiny suit, windowpane suit that goes exactly with the fish, if it's fish, that he's giving.
Oh, no, that is.
That has to be, right?
Yes.
I don't think you can turn people into fish.
No, yeah, I can verify that is absolutely fish. There's no part of the human body that replicates the marbling and the color of that. I can attest to that. I've seen it.
So I like how then the audience, they're just messing with the audience with the, well, he was a flounder
thing. Yeah, he was a flounder.
Yes.
But yeah, so I love that they match the meat to his outfits.
Yeah.
Well, he would coordinate like that.
Of course he would. Of course he would. He's into that.
And the moment, it's repeated, obviously, because this scene is repeated again. But the moment that really stands out for me in this is Hannibal leaping at the door, because it's the moment you really understand the monster that's always been there.
Mm-hmm.
And now that the monster is out, what the hell does that mean for poor Jack in the pantry?
Well, Mads Mikkelsen has years of training, and he had a career. He started out as a professional dancer and a gymnast. And so he has this immense background, obviously. Fans of genre fiction also will know, Lawrence Fishburne, hey, he's Morpheus, right? Yeah. So guy's got some, you know, fight.
He knows how
well.
To fight a little bit.
He knows
bit.
How to fight a little bit as well. But it's just so wonderful. It's so rare that we get to see that element to Mikkelsen's abilities. And so yeah. It's great to see it come out here. It was so much fun with Tobias and Fromage.
Yes.
And again, when it, like you said, it's that moment. It's that the agility of how much he bends together as he's going over that table. He's all of a sudden, he's an animal. He's more than just human. He's something else.
And the moment that Jack's moment that really hit me was he does this thing with the knife. Like he grabs the knife and it's in the wrong direction, so he flips it twice, and then it is his weapon then. You know, it's an extension of his hand. The way he wraps his tie around the hand that just got stabbed, but then is also using it as a weapon. Jack is using his bureaucracy as a weapon, and Hannibal is using his cooking as a weapon.
The one time Hannibal doesn't have a tie.
The one time Hannibal doesn't have a tie. That's interesting, too. How about the moment where Hannibal smiles at Jack, and then you see the realization go over his face, okay, Jack knows.
Yes.
How are we going to play this? And they give each other this, are we really going to do this look?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's on.
Yeah. What I liked, too, about that interaction was when Hannibal throws the knife and it goes into Jack's hand, you do not see a single second of weakness.
No.
He pulls it at that point. He turns on that, like you said, the animalistic instinct. This is survival combat. He doesn't flinch. He pulls it right out of his hand while keeping maintaining eye contact with Hannibal that whole time. And then, like you said, he turns it into his weapon, and he's slashing at Hannibal. And he doesn't even, for a second, think, okay, I'm wounded, until later when he has the opportunity to use his tie as a tourniquet. And also, I was thinking when I saw that, because I have a friend who does MMA, I'm thinking, okay, you wrap your fist, and then shortly after is when he is punching Hannibal
and
in the face.
And pummeling him, too.
Pummels him, and that's something you would do. You would wrap your wrist, or you wrapped your hand before you would, to do that, to kind of, you know, keep that hand, actually, I don't know. Why they do that, but anyway, it reminded me.
I imagine it helps with the knuckles.
Yes. Okay, so it would prevent him from further injuring.
Says a guy who also has no idea what MMA
further injuring his already injured hand. Yeah, so it would keep and also it would reduce the friction, which would reduce the damage to his own knuckles. Yeah, that makes sense.
So we leave Lawrence Fishburne in the pantry.
Yes.
Looking panicked.
Well, he's bleeding.
Bleeding horribly.
Horribly.
Yeah.
That's an arterial spray.
You know, is that...
That is signature.
By the way.
That is what that is.
Signature arterial spray. It's a Hannibal specialty.
Well, but this is something I wanted to talk about in the last episode, but I realized I couldn't. When we were talking about how they could do Silence of the Lambs. And one of the things I suspect... And this has nothing to do with anything else that happens this season or anything else I know, is that Will Graham may wind up as the mentor that Jack Crawford is in Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, interesting.
Because okay, that so makes that, the most sense.
Yeah.
You know, Lawrence Fishburne is a really busy guy.
Mm-hmm. He has a new show this fall.
He has a new show. And
well,
so
there you go.
For him... I think that'd be a really interesting dynamic that they could play with, because then Jack Crawford could be more hands-on with Clarice. Wouldn't it be really interesting to see Will training an FBI agent and with Hannibal and how to deal with Hannibal?
Right.
So because, there's a lot of possibility there.
Okay. That makes total sense. Especially.
And again, by saying this, I am not telling you anything about Jack Crawford's
nothing.
Faith.
Okay.
Faith.
Fate.
Have faith in Jack Crawford.
Crawford. Okay.
I believe in Jack Crawford.
I believe. It seems like you should be saluting when you say I believe in Jack Crawford.
So then we go to dinner with Jack Crawford.
Yes.
Which was nice, because then he did not look nearly as terrified.
Yes. Although one thing I just to go back.
Yes.
We talked about this. The Hannibal, with a methodical, really super creepy way, he repeatedly like beat his body against the door to open it. Just head down. It was like we got to see the monster.
Yes.
You know, before that, he's the cultured man. He's been hiding it. And in that fight,
he shows us.
He shows us. And it is. It's really frightening the way he's determined. And he's just going to keep beating that door until it goes down.
And especially how we've talked about how Mass is so, like, level with his performance, so that any little nuance is a huge ping. And this episode is full of smiles,
yes,
and and emotion, and even disgust when Hannibal sees those bodies out on the bridge.
Oh yeah, you could tell.
He looks he looks either disgusted or perplexed, like he doesn't understand what he's looking at.
It's a waste of perfectly good meat.
That's true. If he's only going to throw it in the river.
River, really? Do you know there are starving kids in Africa?
But no, I love the physicality of that, though. How many times have we seen a show where somebody like kicks down a door and they like they have like in a stilettoed heel and they just hit it in just the right way and it like pops? He's charging full speed. Yeah. He's got a dislocate. I mean, how does he not dislocate his shoulder doing that?
I'm sure he is, but he's just so motivated.
It doesn't matter.
And so focused.
And we see that from Jack as well when he's holding Hannibal over on his back.
Yeah, the determination.
He's like an ox, and it really shows you
the flip.
Yeah, absolutely. It shows you the true physicality and strength, and through that also the character of who these two people are. One is so agile and fast and strong, and the other is just, like you said last season, he was wrong then, but he's right here. He's bedrock. Mm-hmm. He's just a rock. And I love seeing those two forces come together. You got to imagine Hannibal is loving actually having a worthy opponent.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
He appreciates it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I wanted to mention, too, the realistic point where Jack uses his tie to strangle Hannibal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually something that they have recommended in self-defense classes. If somebody is trying to strangle you with an object, to try to get your hand underneath it if you can.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely depict that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So we see Hannibal with his hand underneath it. So what you can actually do is hold it still and keep it from crushing your windpipe.
Mm-hmm.
And then it almost feels like he lets it go slack, but he still keeps it away from his windpipe and then pretends to pass out.
Yeah.
And then he's on the floor and Jack thinks he's won and he's getting that look.
And we get a slasher movie moment where he's got his eyes closed and then he opens them and goes right for the glass.
So that is actually something that's plausible. Mm. That they didn't, you know, overstep reality.
As violent and physical as this sequence was, there was really not a moment when I felt it was over the top.
No.
Because you do have it's two opposing forces, like you said. And it's two forces who know that the entire rest of their life depends on the outcome of this event.
Mm-hmm.
And for Jack, we don't know what Jack knows at this point. But
we
know he knows that Hannibal is a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And so stopping Hannibal is paramount.
Yeah.
And Hannibal doesn't know what Jack knows. All he knows is Jack cares enough to do this. So it must be bad.
Right.
You know, he left his Wound Man book open in the living room. Why would he leave the Wound Man book open?
Why did they never learn?
Or if we want to go with the Red Dragon simplified version, he notated sweetbreads in a medical textbook.
Yes.
Damn Brett Ratner, we could have done so much better.
Could have done so much more.
And I liked in the intro, before the fight begins, the reflection in the knife.
And then, yeah.
And we talked about how that's slightly implausible given the type of knife.
I don't buy it. Yeah. By we meaning me, I didn't buy the reflection.
You didn't buy
it,
and neither do I, considering the type of steel that's used or the metal that's used in those types of high class knives. But the reflection in the knife is interesting because we first see it's almost like
we have Hannibal seeing the reflection of Jack first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's this realization, like, okay, my opponent has just entered the room. And then it switches and we see Hannibal resting it. And the way he rests it,
mm-hmm.
he puts it down over the salad bowl like you would a weapon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't set it gently.
I might need this here.
I'm going to put the handle here so that I can reach it in a second if I need to. And then we see the reflection of Hannibal's face.
Yes, in that.
We see that almost, okay, this is the turning point. This right here is the pivotal moment where we're not just going to have civilized conversation, that it's on.
Mm-hmm. I think Hannibal sees who Jack really is.
Mm-hmm.
Or sees his realization that he knows who Hannibal really is.
True. Mm-hmm. But then Hannibal sees who he really is. And then puts it on.
Mm-hmm.
The person suit comes off.
Right.
The monster is out.
I love the very, you know, philosophical or very well thought out approach you have. Because for me, it's in this corner.
Tonight. A battle royale.
Absolutely. Because it's ridiculous. I mean, that angle and the reflection, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's completely heightened.
Yeah. Right.
But
we all agree with
in
that.
In the moment, it just so works.
And you go with it.
You just go with
you're
it.
You're okay with it.
Because it's so awesome.
I knew they were taking me somewhere. I knew they were doing this. It was manipulative. None of this was meant to be real. I know that's not really that. It's all symbolic, and I'm okay with it. Because, like I said, everything about that whole beginning sequence is very sort of, like, you know, surreal, you know, somewhat like, you know, kung fu movie meets Hong Kong, you know, thriller meets spaghetti western. It is. It's all.
That's quite a pastiche going on there.
You totally get that. The da.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
I'm surprised Brian Reitzel resisted the urge to put something like that in.
Oh, totally. Well, I mean, I love that transition we get in the music from the great, and I'll just mention this now.
Mm-hmm.
This elements of this may come back later, and if so, I want people to think about the music when that happens. Enough said. But I love the scoring in that fight scene, cutting immediately to, I think it's Schubert, which is so civilized. The piano, very very it's ordered, like, very
fight is over.
Yep, and then that goes through the entire dinner, and then we go to Will in nature.
Yeah,
Will's happy place theme. The piano there. So we have the percussion. Then we go to the piano by Schubert, an impromptu. Unless I have it confused with the Chilton dinner, but I think that's the piece. And a percussion instrument again, piano. And then we go to the stream, and Will's piano happy theme comes in as well. So all these different approaches to the same family of instruments, depending on the character in the moment. It's great.
And it is worth bringing up. I know we haven't really talked about this, but seasons one and two's soundtracks are out on these double albums. And rather than just do themes, he's taken and constructed these massive tracks, like 15-minute tracks, of the episode. So episode one has a 15-minute track that takes us through the episode. So you can listen to it. And when I first got it, I put it on when we were going to sleep.
Oh, yeah.
And like it was lovely at the beginning. And then you sort of feel like you've gone through the cycle. And then it happens again and again and again. It's almost exhausting to listen to, but just wonderful. And if you're a fan of the soundtrack, it's so nice to hear it isolated like that because there's so much depth and unusual elements to it. And we heard some of that tonight. To jump way ahead, when the pipe is being inserted into Will.
Oh, yes.
There's that you know, all I could think about, you remember those toys that were like little tubes that you could scrunch and pull apart.
It sounded like you were slowly pulling those apart.
I have a comment about this.
About the scene? Do you want to wait till then? Or do you want to hit? You look serious.
I am very, very serious. I am very serious about this. So, what...
Are you going to tell us it's not real? It's not realistic?
I am.
Okay.
So, if you look at the gauge of the tube,
and the thickness of the tube, and the fact that it was not tapered at the end when it was inserted. And if you've ever seen a tracheotomy tube, what they actually would use to insert into a throat, this is larger. It has a larger gauge. And what, from a medical standpoint, when something like that would be inserted without any lubrication or tapered, it wasn't tapered though.
No, it wasn't tapered.
You could see when the tube came down that it had just been cut.
Right.
It was just, you could see the diameter or the thickness of the tube, and it was just pushed down. So with no tapering of this tube, what would have happened was Will would have known, even with his psychosis and his memory loss, he would have had, even with people who've been trached, there is a horrible pain in your throat. There is sometimes coughing up of blood. There's so many different actual physical presentations that would have triggered him into thinking, okay,
maybe someone jammed an ear down my throat.
Well,
perhaps?
No, not necessarily that, but he would have felt that something horrible had been done to him, because it actually
it
would isn't
have physically had some kind of after effect.
If you've ever seen or heard or talked to somebody who's been trached before, it is something that you will never forget, that pain of healing from. It is actually and the fact that they didn't use what appeared to be a medical grade tube, it actually looks like some sort of a piping that you would use.
Plumbing supply.
Very interesting. It was not medical grade. Which
Hannibal was picking that up while Dahmer was picking up a big drum.
Which surprises me, because he's supposed to be a surgeon. He's supposed to have
He was a surgeon.
Okay, but he worked as an ER surgeon.
Yeah.
He should have known the proper way to trach someone and to shove the ear into the throat.
True.
And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Perhaps our unreliable narrator, Will, is imagining a much larger tube.
Okay.
We've talked a lot about that lately.
The perception.
The fact that we can't really believe anything we see.
It's a wonderful way to get around inconsistencies.
It is.
It's very convenient.
It's true.
It's a hallucination.
But I have
to
point these things out.
I think absolutely.
Absolutely.
I'm just way too over.
And I have to bring us all the way back from the end of the episode
back
to the beginning, where we are eating dinner.
What I love is when we go through the sequence of, cutting the fish. And everything, all this. But then we go to get it going into the presentation to Jack. And Jack is lost in thought.
Yes, I think he may be having a black and white flashback.
Right, exactly. Maybe Miriam struck me.
He's thinking about Miriam.
He's thinking about the arm. He hears her voice.
He's probably thinking about Will. Like when he walked into the classroom, it's like, remember when Will was still sort of sane?
But he's ruminating something. He's lost. He's in the museum of his own mind.
And Hannibal never feels guilty eating
anything. There are some beautiful, wonderful lines.
This is again a return to the ask me about cannibalism button that I think Hannibal should be wearing, because all his one-liners just throw that out. Aunt Murasaki is a character from Hannibal Rising.
Oh, okay, I'm not there yet.
Murasaki is... I don't know much about Hannibal Rising. I haven't seen the movie, haven't read the book. I've been trying to keep myself pure of what is considered resoundingly the worst entry in the Hannibal Lecter saga. But Murasaki is the one who basically takes young Hannibal and molds him in a lot of ways. Fighting and cuisine, and there's a lot of things. And Murasaki is supposedly going to be a character in season 3. That's the hope. So, I thought it was nice that they name dropped her, and I think they name dropped her in order to then introduce.
Right.
Because I think Brian Fuller would never just throw something like that out. So, they talk about how Will is a loss. and how they're mourning him. And this is the meal where we mourn Will. This is the funeral meal for Will.
I was watching Top Chef Duels. Which is,
I know, I was too, just now.
But they had sea urchin, and I, for some reason...
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
I didn't realize this before, but now that I know that that is a tongue, it makes so much creepier. Here's a little tongue to go with your fish.
Like the last season where it was an incredibly chatty lamb.
Yes. So that was that was my only thought on the food, besides it always looking gorgeous and pristine and everything. But
to me, there was a little too much skeleton for my taste in that meal. Just a little too much.
Too much skeleton?
Yeah, wasn't it being served on the bony interior?
No, that was a shell. That was a shell.
Oh, okay. I never have any idea. I have a problem with bones.
Yeah, because he was serving flounder, which is it would be fish bones. There wouldn't be anything you could. And uni is squid. Just the sea urchin shell and squid, which doesn't have any, kind of skeleton.
No, really.
Okay.
Well, it has the external skeleton, the exoskeleton.
Let's talk about Hannibal playing his little games with Jack now. Mm-hmm. Hannibal is done pushing Will to see where he goes, because we saw where he went.
Right.
Now he's pushing Jack. So, you should trust your bloodhound. Look where he points. Yeah. He's pointing at me. Look!
Oh, he's totally goading him, too.
And then there's this look on Hannibal's face, like,
huh? Are you gonna?
That's how we're gonna play this.
Yeah. Well, then you must. Ophelia has a lot more confidence in Hannibal's planning.
I do.
I have a lot of sense that Hannibal is so smart he can roll with any situation. So he's constantly just, well, what if I blow this up? Ooh, interesting. So I think he's constantly pushing in directions because he has no idea what's going to happen. But he's confident he can play with it if it does.
In this particular case, though, there's no way Hannibal would leave any trace in anything
except for his
that
hair.
Could be found.
He needs a bonnet. He needs a plastic bonnet. What about a clear plastic fedora?
I think they should make like a hoodie.
Hoodie, there you go.
Clip on, like
zips up in the front.
Yeah, totally.
Or maybe he needs one of those hair nets.
Yeah.
Like he's working in the lunchroom.
That's awesome. To go with his new highlights?
Right, exactly.
So we do get to experience Happy Will in the river, and the raven stag comes to him. And so at the end of the last episode, he theoretically shot the raven stag, and it became the Wendigo. Mm-hmm. So do we get the sense that this is the first time Will has seen the raven stag since that?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know whether... it probably is. To me, it seemed like the raven stag needed to come back to tell him, he's in another stage.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to know other things. And so the raven stag is sort of back to go, okay, we've got more to do.
It's Mufasa in the clouds.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I also feel like this part sort of, for me... deconstructs the theory that I had at the last episode that we recorded, that the raven stag maybe isn't representation of the friendship between Will and Hannibal, and maybe it really is the goodness of Will.
Which is complicated by the fact that Brian Fuller talks about it being the representation.
It is contradictory.
But you do get this sense that there are the things that Brian Fuller believes and the things Brian Fuller says and the things that are actually going on and the things we believe.
Well, I found it really interesting that when Hannibal walks up to the
sound... That he was the raven stag?
The hoof that you see is the raven...
I tried to talk myself out of that. I tried to believe that the Wendigo has hooves.
Have hooves.
Which is still possible.
Which is still possible. We've never seen the bottom half yet.
Mm.
Okay. Never mind then. To be continued later in the season
and later on.
Where do you come down on the representation of the raven stag, Kate?
Well, I got to talk to Brian Fuller briefly at Comic-Con at a round table about it.
And, now you're just bragging.
Along with a room full of people.
It's only because you're jealous.
I am.
And I asked him directly about it, and he gave the answer that you said.
Okay.
About it being a representation of their relationship, which is very complicated. Mm. But then, like you said, I believe strongly in the sense that once something is out, a creator has released something, it's very interesting to know what they thought and what they were trying to do. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what happened. And one need look no further than a certain scene in Game of Thrones last season to understand that.
Yeah.
So while I, you know, that knowing what he thinks has influenced the way that I view those scenes. So, for example, this time when I was watching it, with that influence, you know, in the back of my brain, because previously he had said that he thought of it as Will's Patronus, which to me just means positive, happy, light, goodness, protector, which is completely contradictory
to that other thing.
So I always thought of it very positively, but this time when I'm watching it, I hear the music changes and becomes just really discordant or minor. Like, it creeps in. There are these shifts in the orchestration and the tonality of it where it becomes unsettling. So you could take that as this malignant force entering his mind palace, which is then heightened later when we see the Wendigo rise out of the water.
Yeah.
Or it could be a warning of, you're not done yet. You can't just stay here. So it depends on how you want to think about it.
Because I really do believe that the Wendigo is Will. You know, like, I feel like Winston represents the goodness in Will. Not the Wendigo, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I really don't think the
Wendigo I really feel the Ravenstag. Ravenstag is Will.
Ravenstag, okay.
Winston represents Will's goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But the Ravenstag is the entirety of Will. Mm. Because it's both things. It's the raven and the stag, you know, it's...
Do you think it has changed since he shot it? And do you feel like it's something different because the Wendigo has emerged from it or separated, and so now this complicated representation in the first season has a positive and a negative element that are no longer entwined.
That's an interesting idea.
Mm. Well,
No, it's an interesting idea whether you believe it or not.
You're right.
Well, supporting evidence is in last season, or the final season of or final episode of season one, was with the slaughter or supposed slaughter of the Raven Stag.
And then the theoretical Wendigo consuming the Raven Stag.
So it does kind of support that from that scene.
And we had talked about on the end of the last episode how the Wendigo consumes its victims and grows large enough to support the victims and so gains their abilities and powers and memories and thoughts.
The Native American folklore of a Wendigo.
And so if that's where they're going with this, the Wendigo did consume the Raven Stag and became something altogether different, but the Raven Stag is still important enough to the person whose mental situation is creating it, Will, that it wasn't just taken away by
right.
it.
Right.
So yeah, there's a lot of stuff there.
There's a lot of stuff.
In a scene with no dialogue, there's a lot of stuff.
And it's beautifully shot.
Discussion.
Just the slow rush motion of the water. It's all in slow motion, but you really get that feeling that he's in that rush.
Mm-hmm.
It's back to those earth tones that, you know, he's been slowly been taken out of as he's changed.
And they become so contrasting to Will's actuality, which is the dark blue prison suit.
Mm-hmm.
So to have him out in the wild in beautiful Toronto.
Yes.
In this costume, it's as much of a contrast as you could have between
even just the cinematography, even just like it's yellows, oranges. It's like just and then it's blue light. It's light blue, but it feels like there's a blue filter at least.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Everything is clean and sterile, but it's not just white. It's not just fluorescent overhead lights.
Mm-hmm.
It's that cold, detached blue, and it's so nice to have that moment of just a moment of happiness. We get it later with Alana and the dogs. Well. It's just like, oh, thank God. I needed something
oasis.
This is getting a little dark.
Yeah. And Chilton, we get some comedy with him, too.
Yeah.
But,
So let's talk about Chilton.
Yeah, because then you realize that you're just in Will's mind. Mm-hmm. And we're coming back to Will. He's in his present. And I love just Chilton just chattering away, and the little bits and pieces of the dialogue that sneak in.
How does that make you feel?
It reminds me of the Peanuts. Whenever an adult would speak, because it's all distorted. You see his mouth moving, and he's just like intensely trying to engage with Will. Will is like,
whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And then Chilton is like, How does that make you feel? Like, it comes in, and you know that the full sentence was, How does that make you feel?
And it makes him feel like he's sitting in a dunking tank, and you're lobbing softballs to make a splash.
Right. And you keep missing
the target.
Wow.
Yes.
The dialogue is epic.
Yes. And Chilton's like this bitch with this, too. Yes. It's just like, well, you know what? I've got plenty of time. You're in my hospital now.
Right, you're my patient.
I'll just sit here and lob softballs until you go down.
I love how you are in my web.
I love how he has not grown since his experience is able to
do that. Right.
If anything, he's gotten worse.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. He's missing a kidney now. He's a little patchwork together.
He has to be careful with his protein intake.
Oh, God, that's funny. I think, though, my favorite Chilton moment is just that brief cutaway we get to with when Alana is talking to Will later, and he's just
playing
with his pen.
Yeah.
As he's like, well, it's like, so, I can watch over them. I'm so powerful.
Yeah.
Watch me finger my pen.
So into what they were doing in Silence of the Lambs. I mean, you see that moment and you see Anthony Held as Chilton listening to the little tiny tape recorder in Silence of the Lambs. Mm. And this episode is full of Silence of the Lambs references. Mm.
Yes.
You know, again, the dungeon cell is right out of Silence. Mm. But before we get that, the Wendigo rises from the river.
Yes.
Because Will wants to talk to Dr. Lecter, and I love it. I'm not talking to you, Frederick. I don't even respect you enough to call you Doctor.
My friend, Hannibal, I'm going to call Dr. Lecter. Yeah.
Yeah, that I thought was very interesting because it comes right after his request for Dr. Lecter.
Yeah.
Then he goes, like, he shuts down, closes Chilton out, goes back to his happy place, and then
in that happy place is the Wendigo.
And he rang.
I wanted to go back just a second to the point where we have Hannibal and Jack eating.
Okay.
And Jack says, we can't define Will at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's interesting because we know that Hannibal has completely defined Will.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. He has
no qualms about who Will is, and he obviously is in a position to manipulate him, whereas Jack is still very much confused by his
idealistic impression of
who he wants Will to be, and then this evidence that's contradictory.
Yeah.
Well, and Alana has that too. It's the head versus the heart.
Mm. Yes.
And you see with Alana, it's the same thing she was doing earlier in season one with Gideon. She's just so desperate for there to be an answer that makes it not all just, no, this really, this guy could just do this. And for Will, it's just, it's that, but to an exponential degree because she cares about Will so much. And so she's just struggling. She's so good at lying to herself.
Yeah.
She's like, no, he was just, and that's how this could happen.
And then it's going to be okay.
And he'll eventually be able to go home with the right defense.
He's going
to
have medicine.
But let's be honest, Winston is not going to live long enough to see that Will go home.
No. Not based on this.
Well, I'm more critiquing Alana's thought.
I know.
We love Winston.
Winston to live forever.
Winston is going to live forever because he is a representation of the goodness and Will.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know if that'll live forever. let's talk about Katie Purnell. Purnell. It's a stupid name because...
Well, because it's spelled Cade, first of all.
Yeah.
So all of us who didn't read the books when we were first podcasting about this episode looked up her name online. We're like, oh, Cade Purnell.
Yeah.
Felt like a jerk.
she is Paul Krendler. And Paul Krendler is
sort of the bad guy in Hannibal, sort of. He's the bureaucratic nightmare that closes things down somewhat in Silence of the Lambs and majorly in Hannibal. He's got it in for Clarice in Hannibal. And fun little spoiler about Hannibal. Paul Krendler is eventually fed his own brain that is cooked at the table in front of him by Hannibal.
That's cheery.
And so Brian Fuller has actually thrown out, will we get to see Hannibal feed Katie Purnell her own brain? Who knows?
Who knows?
Which would be lovely. I would enjoy seeing...
point out the word scramble there, or the
Oh, yeah. So the reason she's Paul Krendler is, and the reason her name is so stupidly spelled, is because it is a direct anagram of Paul Krendler. That's why there are two R's in her last name in weird places.
I love that Jack is finally in the principal's office.
Yes, for the first time ever.
Yes. He has to be held accountable now.
And he's in the worst principal's office ever. It's just like, yeah, so, you know, this bad thing you did, let's just pretend this didn't happen. And how dare you mention it, Alana?
And I like how she's, what did you think would happen to Alana? And Alana's like, it was the right choice. Stick by it.
Even Jack's like, yes, she's strong-willed. She did what she thought she should do. But the line about the federal examiner is someone who arrives at a battlefield post-battle and bayonets the wounded. You have wounded Jack.
Jack.
What a crime.
Who do you think is going to get the bayonet?
Yeah. Oh, poor Jack. That'll but really, he should know better.
Cynthia Nixon is really fun. And it's
she's
like,
awesome.
It's like a one scene, at least in this episode, right? Roll?
Yeah, only one scene.
Yep.
Very memorable, a lot of fun.
One scene who I don't even know if they had fully intended whether or not she was going to be in the series again after this episode.
Yeah.
So it was a cool little one-off. And yeah, Jack in the principal's office is lovely. We see a lot of Dr. DeMaurier in this episode.
And her lovely home.
Yes. The dialogue between the two of them has gotten... Believe it or not, even more heightened than the dialogue in the last episode, because they really don't really speak like people do anymore.
In the past couple of episodes that she's been in, I've been somewhat like fascinated with her speech pattern.
She's very slow and deliberate.
And she's got this kind of hushed kind of way, breathy way of speaking, and it's not natural.
No.
Everything in the way she speaks, the word choices are not... This is not even in a therapy session is this conversational It's like a series of metaphors, and it's so deep. There are times it just doesn't seem like it's a real human being, and I know that we've kind of discussed this before.
Whether or not she actually exists.
Yeah.
Would she be hallucinating?
But...
Well, I even went so far as to say that if we don't trust any narration in this series, then she could be an illusion of Hannibal's. Mm-hmm. But then Jack and Alana have now met her, so really it's all unraveling.
Yeah.
Oh, you have a theory that sticks with?
Yes.
Dr. DeMaurier is a phantom.
Okay, so we have Hannibal possibly hallucinating Dr. Maurier's existence.
Mm-hmm.
And then with a psychopath and their tendencies, the paranoia that comes along with it, perhaps he's paranoid that Jack and Alana have been commiserating with his theoretical or pretend therapist who he goes to see for help.
I think we may be going way, way far with... I think it's far
this
more
is
likely...
deep down the rabbit
that
hole,
...that Dr. DeMaurier is just an agoraphobic, like we also thought, and doesn't leave her house.
And it's probably super intelligent, and that's why she's
I just had to play devil's advocate
well done.
There.
Well, it's fun, but for me, what works better is just that... Because I love Gillian Anderson's performance in this episode, particularly. But yeah, like you said, it's not conversational at all.
No.
Because you could see her just like, it's just, her face is a consistent, especially in her second scene. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
And so, like, you could see, but she knows she can't say that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's why she's so paused and measured and not speaking maybe the most naturally, because... Mm. She knows just... She's terrified of him, clearly, based on this scene, these two scenes. So she she knows how... She's smart enough to know how she needs to speak to Hannibal to not get herself killed. And so, yeah, so I think that's what I would attribute the any stilted elements to it, or any maybe if it's the conversation is not believable as being very natural or correct for a therapy session. That's what I would attribute it to. Mm. But I just love how, and also Mads Mikkelsen's performance in this as well. It's so fun to think back to my initial reactions to the show. It's like, he's so subtle. It's such a... But it feels like he's screaming.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout the episode.
He's smiling.
And her, too.
Oh, yeah. The little knowing smiles. And the... Yeah. She's giving it all away at this point.
But yeah, Bedelia, she ain't got time for this.
No. I think you've got a good point there. And what she's also doing... is she's speaking deliberately non-conversational because she doesn't want to converse with him if she can help it. And clearly, since the last episode and the dinner sequence that they had, because they had a nice dinner together, but clearly she is more and more unnerved by what he's become with Will behind bars. Because it's possible Will was also a stabilizing agent for Hannibal.
Yeah,
because Hannibal had a project,
right? He had something
and now
to focus
his
on.
Friend is gone.
Well, and like she says, it's an obsession.
Yeah.
It's not a hobby; it's an obsession now.
He's intrigued.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
he's obsessively intrigued.
So there's something that was more in his control, and a curiosity for him has become an utter obsession.
Mm.
And the. Brian Fuller just loves the chair made of antlers line so much that he feels the need to trot it out again by having Hannibal repeat it.
Right. The that Will is considers himself
his mentality grotesque but useful.
Grotesque but useful, like a chair of antlers.
And then we lead to what can't you repress?
Yes, Hannibal. And that's
and the smile.
Smile.
So we have another Dr. Du Maurier scene in this episode, which again, you hit it on the head. She looks terrified in this scene. Mm-hmm. She has lost all leverage she has over Hannibal Lecter.
Well, and she's lost her shield of to get away with not having to talk to Jack.
Oh, yeah.
Like, patient, confident, I can't talk to you, and
this is my informed consent.
And she's like, what? Why are you doing this? What? This is, she, totally backpedaling and...
Yeah.
Yeah, she's not happy with his choice at all. But it puts her in a position of having to figure out what to say about him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and that is really difficult, And whether or not she's hiding things that she knows that we have been supposing that she knows, that there's far more of a reveal, or she can see or knows more about him than she's letting on. You're setting me up to lie.
Yeah.
For you.
Well, you maintain an air of transparency while putting me in a position to lie.
To lie.
Again.
Yes. Again.
And for whatever reason, the air of transparency line just recalls Hannibal's kill suit for me.
Oh, yes.
That he's wearing a kill suit.
Yes.
But he's just wearing his suits underneath.
Yeah.
He's still Hannibal underneath. Mm-hmm. It's interesting there. How about Hannibal's glee about having gotten to be Will Grant?
Yes.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I get to be Will Grant.
He says it with the joy of, I got to go to the fire department, and they let me slide down the pole.
Right.
And I got to ring the bell.
Ring the bell, yep.
Yeah.
He is. You can tell he's... And you don't know whether it's just the thrill of being able to completely become somebody and see it, or because of who he is. And you have to remember, this is still the same man who has written letters to journals. Thank you. I don't know why I couldn't get that word out. And is always out there talking about his theories on things, and now he gets to go in
and be the guy.
Yeah. It is. It's a childlike glee.
It is. Mm-hmm. And it's another one of those moments like in the first season when they were talking about tracing the ambulance.
That's
and he was like, this has been very informative.
Right. This is awesome.
We're learning things all over the place today.
I got to file that away. I may use that later.
But the chilling moment that we end this scene, and this is the last time we see Dr. Du Maurier in the episode, when she says, Jack Crawford doesn't know what you're capable of. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what she knows he's capable of yet. But clearly, as Hannibal says, neither do you.
Neither do you.
And the terror on Gillian Anderson's face.
Mm-hmm.
You run and run far at this point. I don't care if you're agoraphobic. You leave the house.
Yeah, you can really tell. I don't know whether it's just a signature of season two that the claws are out now with Hannibal. He is setting things up in ways before where he was trying to be more subtle, but now he's not anymore. Now he's giving these little barbs that are like, be careful, because if you cross me...
But you know. It's because he has seen resounding success
mm-hmm.
from something that should be incredibly hard to do,
mm-hmm.
framing a good man
mm.
for a series of murders that it really ultimately makes no sense
right.
that he committed.
Mm-hmm.
So Hannibal has just achieved this tremendous success and still gets to call that guy his friend. Now it's just like, you know what? I could do this to all of you. You could all be behind bars. So then we talked about the Ravenstag hooves, but it's Lecter. And
yes.
that brings us to a great sequence between Hannibal and Will,
mm-hmm.
who says, lost in thought, not lost anymore.
Anymore, yes. There's a lot of powerful mm-hmm. language in this one, most definitely.
But I love the idea that Will's thoughts have transitioned to Hannibal's voice.
Yes.
And that must be so tremendously gratifying to Hannibal, because all he's ever wanted was to be inside of Will, was to be the conscience, was to be the devil. You like that, be inside of Will? You can indulge your slash fiction fantasies here.
Okay, yes.
This is a safe space.
There's a lot of fan fiction.
There's a lot of fan art.
Oh, fan art.
Fan art, yes. Fan fiction about the erotic relationship between Will and Hannibal. And when you said that, I'm sorry, I just got overwhelmed with the giggles.
You had the images.
Just... Yes, that is all Hannibal has ever wanted, was to be inside Will. Okay.
Okay, right. You've taken that to another level.
Take it down, and I'm being serious again.
And see.
And Will says, I can't get you out of my head.
Oh, I just can't quit you.
Oh, God. Okay, while you're dealing with that, let's actually talk about the implications of Hannibal's voice in Will's head.
Okay. The implications?
Yeah, what does this mean for characters? I mean, how do you have that in your head? Or is it 100% metaphorical? Like, we have that idea that this show presents things metaphorically rather than literally. So is Will actually literally saying, I don't hear myself anymore, I just hear you?
Well, it's distinctly possible only because he's been going in there and doing those, you know, I'm not your patient, but this is thoroughly therapy, you know, sessions. You know, mm-hmm. that... He's been telling him, you should do this, and you should do this, and how about this, and having that conversation. So it might be now that instead of being his own counsel, as we usually are for ourselves, when we are going through a difficult period or we're trying to figure something out, the voice of counsel within our minds is our own voice. But now it is not his own voice, because mm-hmm. he's been having Hannibal constantly tell him things and, maybe you shouldn't do that, and how about this? And I think that voice of therapy is now the internal voice that speaks back to him.
Well, and of course, we find out in this episode, we see something, a moment that the two of them experienced that we had never seen.
Yeah. So
who knows how many conversations
exactly.
conversations they had during one of his episodes that mm-hmm. he can't remember, or just something that we haven't seen because it was just another day in the life.
Right.
So when Will's saying that there are words that he can hear Hannibal saying.
Yeah.
That he's never said to him.
That he's never said to him. Some of it is that, I think, having his head in his voice in his head, but I think others are, like, just sort of tinkering around in his brain. There's just these moments of therapy, I guess, or just conversations that he doesn't actively remember, but his brain is trying to help him rediscover. Mm. And that would just sounds terrifying to me, by the way, to have Hannibal have your own identity.
Well, one of the first things we ever learned about Hannibal in Silence of the Lambs, which was my introduction to Hannibal, is you don't want Hannibal Lecter in your head.
No.
Nope.
And that was delivered by Jack Crawford there. Yep.
Do not get too close.
Yeah.
Speaking of, you notice how close Hannibal was to the bars?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
He is unafraid.
He's way past that. Like Alana
seriously,
is in
Will,
the police chair, but...
Will could go apeshit and reach through the bars and grab him.
Uh-huh.
Totally possible. The line that really stood out in this sequence for me is, friendship can sometimes cause a breach in individual personhood. That is so creepy that Hannibal saw them as so close they no longer have individual personhood.
Yeah.
But the next line is what really got me.
Mm-hmm.
With Will's retort that there is a million light years.
Oh yeah, we are not friends.
Yeah, we are not friends. There are a million light years between us.
Oh, the light from friendship.
Oh, the light of friendship
for a million years.
For a million years. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was just
which is awesome, epic but also line. Also a little emo.
Okay.
It's a little emo. Will.
Will is emo. Come
Will is emo.
Yes, he's very emo.
He really is.
I love the there will be a reckoning.
Yes. When Will actually has confidence. This is nice. Mm-hmm. Because Will has been so uncertain of himself for really the entire back half of season one.
Mm-hmm.
And now he says, I have clarity about you. I'm going to remember Dr. Lecter. And when I do, there will be a reckoning.
Yeah, because what you did is in my head and I will find it.
Oh, I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Love it. Man.
That is a great, but I love, and also the wonderful, you know, sort of ending to that whole thing of the, you know, there will be a reckoning, is then we get that lovely, creepy, sly smile.
Yeah. Again, just Hannibal's just like, by the way, I'm acting now.
Yeah.
So Hannibal follows up his visit to Will with a visit to the FBI, where he gets a cheek swab, and... Mm-hmm. I felt Beverly was not really on Team Hannibal.
No.
She seemed very snippy and sarcastic with him.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think... She seems like when she's going through it, it's... she's talking about how the evidence presents itself.
Mm-hmm.
And everything. And she's... I really do think, though, she is honest, because he does actually ask if he's... You know, if he's a suspect.
No, he calls himself.
He calls himself, and she denies.
She denies that.
It's his little game that he keeps playing with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's look at I'm a suspect too. We're all suspects, and everyone's like, no, we're not. And he's like, you're right, I'm not. I'm really not.
Really, you are.
He's
totally
he's doing
right.
these little Will is guilty droppings all over the place.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, because Beverly is the closest Will has to a friend in season one. I mean, yeah, he's got the conflicted stuff with Alana, but with Jack, there's too much boss stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much, they have some really great friendship moments, like after Bella and everything with the sitting, you know, there's some really nice. But really, I'm still waiting for the Will and Beverly Blue Skies crime procedural.
I'm on board.
I mean, based on what we saw in season one, clearly that could be a lot of fun.
Mm.
So it makes you know, we don't really see her ever hanging out with Hannibal, but she clearly had a quick and easy rapport with Will, and so it makes sense for her to not be quite so, you know, over the top for Hannibal. And also, yes, Hannibal is very, very fastidious, but as someone who is so focused on evidence and on her job and on the details and the specifics, maybe some part of her is suspicious by the fact that there is nothing on any of his suits. There should be just normal There should be something, but there is nothing.
It's such a complete lack of evidence that it sets off alarms in her head.
Yes.
But he supplements his wardrobe regularly.
Yes.
What do you want to bet he goes home and takes off the kill suit, burns the suit inside it? He just wanted to be wearing the suit at the time.
Right.
He just didn't feel himself without the double Windsor.
But he doesn't need to be seeing that suit again. And he has
that is some serious OCD right there.
Well, I mean, why wear the suit to a kill?
I know. I
or does he just have like a bag with his kill suit in his trunk, so he can when the mood strikes.
Yeah, well, you always have to be prepared.
You do.
Yes.
You don't want to go in and just kill someone.
No.
That's not his style.
I do have a serious question for you guys because I didn't pay attention when we were recording our season 2 podcast, and I thought of it recently, and so didn't pay attention when we were doing our season 1 rewatch. So as you guys are moving forward, I don't know if you have an answer to this already. Does Hannibal wear a tie twice? Because like he wears 3 different ties in this episode. Do we see him wear the same tie?
Let's ask the costume designer.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, his ties do make repeat during the course of the show.
Yeah. Okay.
His suits make repeat appearances.
He really likes that blue one with the red check.
Yeah, the blue with the window pane check comes back a lot. I think we might have actually seen, if not the same or similar suit to the light-colored suit that he has dinner with the... I think it was a Jack at the beginning. It's like a really light-colored suit. Yeah. But I have noticed that his ties and his pocket squares do make return.
Okay.
And it is nice to see someone without an infinite wardrobe on television.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I knew the suits, but I wasn't sure about the ties, so that's good to know.
I think it is rather interesting that he leads her, you know, we have to also believe that he's a man with a gigantic walk-in closet full
of... Oh, of course.
You know,
I want to see Hannibal's closet.
Exquisite
I wonder if he's the kind of person who has multiple versions of the same style.
I imagine he does.
Yeah.
Because if the pants of this suit are not ready to wear tonight, you need the backup. You need the spare. You need it.
I wanted... Something occurred to me that I wanted to pull back. When we were talking about that reckoning that Will referred to...
Oh, yeah, we forgot the rejoinder to that.
Well, there's something that we had mentioned about how... And we've repeatedly mentioned how it's this trial and this test of Will by Hannibal. And... At the end, after, you know, Will has this intense, there will be a reckoning. We have Hannibal almost very lightly, casually saying, I have huge faith in you.
Yes.
And it's like he's just sort of baiting him.
Oh,
like,
you know.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, bring it out. Remember.
Figure me out. And it's that reoccurring theme of testing Will's ability to be... at Hannibal's level.
Is Will bestie material?
Yes. Bestie material.
BFF.
That's the question. Can they be BFF?
Are they going to share a little heart that's broken in the middle?
They are. It is breaking right now. Of course, Will is totally like, you know, freshman year, our friendship couldn't be seen for a million years.
Light years, exactly. It's over.
I don't ever want to see you again, Hannibal.
No, leave your stuff out on the curb.
We can't skip over Beverly's amazing line about lessons learned from cellular decay.
Yes.
Enjoy the world while you have it. Leave a little behind.
Yeah, that was amazing. I love that reference.
That was great. And then he kind of mentions that's what he's done. He's left a little bit behind. And answer to that is hopefully not your DNA.
Yeah.
Right. Oh my goodness. There. And that's the other thing. It's almost like for a second there, she lashes out at Hannibal.
Well, I think she does. Yeah.
She snipes at him, and then she immediately retracts it and says, "I'm not blaming you. We all should have noticed it."
Right.
And then she also makes that, you know, that other comment about, you know, you're not a suspect. She pulls back, and then she says, "You are the new Will Graham," which I thought was an interesting take on that. That whole scene there where she's doubting Hannibal and his intentions, and then retracting it because she feels like she may have prejudged him. But with her gut instinct, she's like, you were supposed to be monitoring
him. Right.
How come you didn't see this? And then she's like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, we all should have noticed this. We were all Will's friends. We were all close to him. And then at the end, she says, you're not a suspect. You're the new Will Graham. And that is another section where we see that the little perk.
Yeah.
Where he's like, ooh.
I get to be the new Will Graham.
I'm so happy.
The only thing I'll say about that, there's some cello scoring right immediately following that. When we have, and we talked about this earlier, timpani too, but cello, yes. While Hannibal is at the crime scene,
mm-hmm.
there will be more prominent Hannibal cello scoring later in the season.
Yeah.
So, you know, wait for that.
little thing to look forward to.
Just listen for it, yep.
How nice was it to see Alana playing with the dogs?
Yes, it was very sweet.
Running around. And the way they've done this a few times this episode with the incongruent picture and audio.
Mm-hmm.
So she's playing with the dogs while talking to Will,
mm-hmm.
talking about how Winston keeps running away, but he's going home.
Yes.
Yeah. And I teared up.
Aww.
I did. I love Winston so much.
The delivery from Duranis of home was also just,
mm-hmm.
it was such a warm delivery.
He goes
of that.
Home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how Will throws back, you know, he won't find me there.
Yes. And not for, and then they sort of have that discussion about how long, it won't be for long, and if you get the right counsel, and you know, he doesn't have any, and that whole thing of, you know, the idea that this could drag on, you know,
for a long time.
And that, you know, there's a good possibility that he could be convicted and not be around for a long time. And trying to think what that means to the life of his dogs.
Well, and Lana argues that Will shouldn't be held liable due to unconsciousness. It's like this is her defense. It's like, Will can have whatever theories about Hannibal he wants, but this is what we need to play because this is how you eventually get to go home.
Right.
And it must hurt so much to Will to be doubted like that because that the unwillingness to even discuss any other possibility and say this is your defense is that you did it,
mm-hmm.
but you don't remember.
Right.
And, I mean, that's the betrayal from his friends. Is you did it, so let's stop pretending otherwise.
Right. Pretty much everybody has signed off on that. Just, you know, despite the fact that he's still adamant about it. He's like, no, if I can't remember it, doesn't mean that I did something, can't remember. There's a good chance I didn't do anything. Why are we not looking into that option other than trying to find out how to justify that I did it, but I was sick?
Mm-hmm.
You know, his frustration with the inability of everybody to kind of take that road that he's on or his, you know, angle. He was like, I don't remember it because I didn't do it.
Right.
Yeah. You know.
And that was the autonomism that she was referring to, where you are not conscious of the things that you are doing, like with his sleepwalking.
I assume like an automaton?
Yes, yes.
Because I tried to parse that word when she said it's like, that's probably automaton, which, okay, I could see that being the you know, derivation of that.
Mm.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about black oil, Alana.
Oh my gosh. Well, I like that. I like the idea where he goes, well, what if I could
remember? Yeah, what if I could remember?
Yes.
Where I'm just going to take what you just said and throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
And
let's put a pin in that.
Yes.
Let's put a pin in the defense.
That's
and instead,
your theory. Let's talk about mine.
But it's very, you know, it's very interesting that he's the one that brings up, you know, have you ever done, help people, you know, find, you know, repressed memories. And it is kind of funny that how far now has he been, how long has he been in prison? Basically everything that's holding him there is that he can't remember anything, and he's the one, the only one that thinks, oh yeah, that's right, can't you do this thing?
Yeah, I know this.
Well, but the repressed memories thing is so controversial because it's so easy for the person, like look at Chilton Yes. And Gideon. Chilton mm-hmm. just repressed a whole lot of memories right into Gideon. So it's real easy for that to be... I mean, they already don't believe Will. So mm-hmm. having really shaky science on top of that, I think it they recognize... Will it, recognizes that it could be even worse for them then.
Yes. Hypnotism and the recollection of memories. When you have somebody in that state, psychologically, they are very susceptible to suggestion. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you don't do it accurately, you could unintentionally be planting a memory. They don't like to use that in criminal cases because, like, you know, with the accidental wording you may use, you mm-hmm. may accidentally convince somebody that something occurred when it actually did not.
Did not.
And it's never really intended unless you are using psychic driving, mm. like Hannibal and Chilton. But, you know, in true cases where you're trying to get down to the truth, it's very shaky science. You are really susceptible to suggestions. When so they try not to do this.
The thing is, Will doesn't care about any of the legal proceedings going on.
Mm-hmm.
What he cares about is... who he really is.
Right.
Will cares about, can we remember this so I don't have to wonder if I did these things. Not so Jack doesn't have to wonder if I did these things, but so I don't have to.
Well, he has such a strong sense of self. It's, mm-hmm. it's really astonishing because a season in, at the end of the season one, he's had months, we find out. They mention here it's only been months, which is kind of mm-hmm. astonishing.
Only been months.
It's sort of like the timeline in Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
When you actually look at how long that show is on, it's like, wait, what?
Yeah, exactly. And Hannibal and Will have only known each other for a matter of months, which mm-hmm. seems crazy. But months of Hannibal's manipulations and encephalitis and all this crazy stuff happening, and yet he's still in that finale, in the episode 12, episode 13 of that season, saying, that's not the type of crazy that I am. He still has a strong mm-hmm. sense of his who he is and his self. And so in this episode, I mean, that's... He knows... He thinks he knows that he didn't do this. So, therefore, he needs to discover what happened and recover these memories. And because it is such a dangerous thing, that's why he's only comfortable with Alana doing it. That's why he's the one. I mean, for all we know, Chilton was like, hey, we could recover those memories.
Yeah.
And he's like,
How about no?
I've met Gideon. I'm good.
Yeah, right? None of that.
That is true. He chooses Alana, who is probably the only person he would trust.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, to do that, because it is putting him in a very... susceptible state.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be someone that one thing I do thought was really cool, that the lighted metronome using is the one from...
It's the inverted.
Yes.
Yeah, it looks like what we've been seeing season long.
Will's pendulum is golden.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, his pendulum is silver. And so to have this... Mm-hmm. Blue light pendulum. Yeah, that was a lovely throwback to mm-hmm. the book.
I can't be the only one who went lightsaber, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're not.
I mean, because normally you don't see the end of the pendulum. And so, but here, because I love those old-timey metronomes, too. I have one at home. And so just by seeing the light end, there's like... I want
the sound effect.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, you said black oil...
Black oil. Thank you for
making it terrible for me, because I go to inky.
What do you see?
Ink.
Oh, okay.
And not, you know, black oil, which has all these X-Files connotations.
Well, yes. That's where I went with it. Yeah.
See, I go... For me, it's a positive thing. I mean, it's obviously very dark and not happy or whatever, but it's still comforting in a dangerous way of losing himself in her. But then how much of that is also her being... dispersed through his influence. I'm curious how you guys read that. Is that a comforting
when myself and Alana? When she splashes onto him?
I have a theory, but I can't talk about it yet.
Oh, no!
Okay.
We run into a bunch of those.
Okay.
So, what I will mention is she's all in black.
like the Wendigo.
And like the victims.
And like the victims, yeah. In the last episode, and I just can't say anything more.
Okay.
But it's interesting, but yes, I will...
We're going to have to talk later, because I have no idea where you're going with this.
Okay, I gotcha. You probably picked up what I'm putting down, but I have
to... Poor Biko.
I have to wait for a little bit before I can flesh this out. And I've done this before, where I have these concepts that I have to wait.
we want to call back.
I'm just going to circle this one for now.
Exactly. Put a pin in that.
Put a pin in that, and we will come back to it later. But I feel like that is something we should hold on to until it's fully fleshed out.
Okay.
But yeah, that kiss also, it's a very intimate moment because, like you said, Elan is one of the people that he trusts.
Mm-hmm.
And they've already shared that kiss and that intimacy. And you know,
and even brought it up again in the finale.
In the finale,
Because of our...
romantic overtures.
Romantic overtures.
But Jack didn't know about those.
Right.
He does now.
No, he does now.
Until now.
Until now, because he's behind the glass.
But what was interesting, too, is that she's not just in the black, but she also has this fluid... Her hair is fluid. There's kind of this... I wouldn't say opalescent, but there's this just shine and movement... When she's going towards Will, before it becomes
I love the movement in the splash. Her hair. It was sort of Gorgon-esque.
Yes.
And, you know, how it was just moving and alive. And everything about her was both sort of beautiful and frightening and sort of bizarrely, like, she was sexy, but in a way... creepy, you know. It was weird. It was so disarming because I felt like I was feeling conflicting things.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything about her eyes were just piercing, and the way her skin was, and the way they changed her voice, the undulating hair was almost. She was like she was a siren.
She had a very Galadriel voice.
Yes.
In that scene too.
Yeah,
and I feel like that was almost a precursor to what Will was about to remember. So it's she was the instrument to help him recall these horrific events that had occurred.
No, he remembers that later. He remembers that by himself.
Mm-hmm.
At this, we go into this table set with death and decay, where the things are dying as we move over them.
Yeah, that.
But he's not remembering that.
Okay, he's not remembering it. Okay.
That's the first stage, though, of him remembering.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. I loved the things are alternatively rotting and moving, like the octopus is moving. I don't know if you noticed, there's an arm on the table.
No.
I didn't notice it the first time. Second time, it's about midway down the table.
I saw the pomegranate,
it's an open hand.
I saw the pomegranate, and there was, like, overly sexual overtures.
Well, and the pomegranate was in season one also.
In the pilot, it was the first, as we panned up to Hannibal, there was a pomegranate.
And it was cut in that same way.
Fruit of the dead.
Yeah. And then you've got the bones that are scattered throughout the table. You have, there was a fly, correct?
I think there were flies. Yeah,
there were flies.
And you saw there was a pig because you saw the skin split as it was rotting.
And then you do see that the octopus undulating.
Yeah, that was so eerie.
It was.
I don't recall the arm.
I can show you. I thought I had seen something like that when we watched it last night.
Table there's set. So much on that table.
Well, and then
you almost even
this
don't
was
know
what
to look
really
at.
Sold that. That imagery to me, though, is when we see the Wendigo at the head of the table, the tablecloth in front of him is all bunched up.
Yes.
Like he is part of the tablecloth. Mm-hmm. Like he has set the table upon himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so creepy to me. I don't even know why. And I love that you only see really the Wendigo from the back.
And then Will's looking down at a pristinely white plate.
With the ear. Yeah. Whew. And then to go right into a dinner sequence at Hannibal's.
Yes.
What is the name of that painting that we talked about? Do you know?
Leda.
In the
Leda
Swan.
Leda the Swan.
Yeah, I'm not. That's the name of the myth.
Okay. Well, there's a painting on Hannibal's wall that needs to be blurred in every episode it's seen in. I recommend you look up Leda and the Swan, Hannibal. It is not safe for work. And you understand why NBC might feel the need to blur it. Mm-hmm. It didn't appear to be blurred on this producer's cut Blu-ray.
Well,
you don't get a good look at it.
For the home viewer.
But for the home viewer, take a look.
It was okay.
And knowing what that painting is, seeing Chilton standing there staring at it.
Yes.
Is,
well,
again,
everything
fantastic.
About Chilton is just, there's this...
Do you understand why I like Chilton now? They both got very upset with me when I said Chilton was one of my favorite characters.
I love the sort of juvenile, rude... he talks with his mouth full and just...
I'm not a fan. I
know you're not a fan. I know.
I'm not a fan just because he's the... I would say snake in the grass, but he's really not even trying to hide
it. He's not.
He just... I don't know. It's a combination of he's a poser. It's a combination of, you know, he wants to be
Hannibal.
Oh, yeah. Witty.
Oh, and he's so childlike about
but
it too.
But he misses just, so
you won't talk
much.
To me. You won't talk to me. He only says
Hannibal.
It's like Marsha. He's kind of whiny in this one.
He is.
He's very childlike. Mm-hmm. And he has a very bratty, spoiled nature about him that just rubs me the wrong
way. He was given everything. You know he was given everything.
But wasn't deserving any of it.
That's why I'm not a fan.
Well, okay.
See, Chilton's hilarious, I think. And I think he's a significant... he plays a significant role on the show, and particularly in episodes like this, because you need some comedy.
Yeah.
And he does provide that. And just... Rollo Sparza is a national treasure. he's fabulous.
He's an international treasure.
Yeah, international.
Yes, and he's so much... I mean, yes, he's fun on Law & Order, but no, it's here. He's a delight as Chilton. I mean, there's so many ways that... I can absolutely see what you're saying, Ophelia, where you don't enjoy the character that much, or maybe the performance, but no, I love Chilton. I love what we have gotten. I love what we will get.
I will say that I love the performance.
Yeah, I do
just
love the
like
performance.
With Freddie Lowndes, or even to make a Game of Thrones reference, Joffrey. I mean, he is so good at portraying that slimy creep that I'm like, oh, I don't like you. Mm. But it's because he's a good actor.
Right.
And because he can perform to that level that I'm like, oh, it's like a Dolores Umbridge moment where I'm just like, I know you're not that person, but I just want to see you in person and slap you across the face. but no, I think that's it. He's such a good actor,
he immerses himself
in this character of what Chilton is supposed to be, that he's so convincing that I just dislike him so much.
And he's a great actor who very quickly made the role his own.
Oh, of course.
Where in
yes.
the first scene we ever see him in season one, he's very much just playing Chilton the way Anthony Held did in Silence and Red Dragon. And so then to take it and go further with it and go a little bit more over the top and showy in a series where people are downplaying
things.
Yes.
It's a brave choice for an actor to make. And it's a choice that has paid off handsomely.
Oh, yeah.
And he gets lines.
Oh, he gets great
that,
lines.
I mean, yeah. He makes me feel like I'm fumbling at his head like a freshman fumbling at a panty girdle. How the fuck old is this man?
Yes, exactly.
Has he ever seen a panty girdle?
I know that's a specific thing that happened to him.
Yeah.
He was in a school play or something.
Like, what were you trying to fill up your grandma? Yeah. What's going on?
Oh my god.
Panty girdle.
But yeah, no, seriously, when was the last time a gentleman of his age that he portrays would have had any reference to a panty girl? That was like a trigger for me. I'm like,
that's why I think it was a specific thing that happened to him.
Well, I think it also, it's one of those lines, you know, there are lines that show up on the show that you feel like that's probably directly from the text. somewhere that's in there.
I know, I can't remember.
I can't either. But we got another silence reference here when he says to Hannibal, oh, he says you're a monster, which is the first words Chilton speaks about Hannibal in Silence of the Lambs. And I felt like he was calling out to Anthony Hopkins' performance as Hannibal when he said, sad to see a respected psychiatrist falling for such hoary old chestnut.
Yes.
The way Hannibal says, you intend to dissect me with this blunt tool, Joel. Agent Starling.
Yes.
Oh my goodness, yes. I like the way that when they're at the dinner table, too, that Hannibal was referring to how he's unfamiliar with creating fully vegetarian dishes.
Yes.
Yes.
And Chilton,
I couldn't kill anything for dinner tonight.
Yeah. And then Chilton was like, well, I did lose a kidney. And Hannibal corrects him.
Yes, you didn't,
you didn't lose it. It was, you had it
taken from you.
Well, and it shows Hannibal still being very grumpy about that man who was pretending to be the Chesapeake River.
Right.
And doing something to Frederick Chilton that Hannibal would very much like to do to Frederick Chilton.
He got you first. Mm-hmm. And then just the delivery on One Can Learn to Love Beats.
Yes. Oh, that is so wonderful. I love the look on his face. It's like one can, you know, it's like this weird sort of like amusing, sort of somewhat whimsical, but defeated at the same time. Like, oh, well, one can
he belongs in a Tennessee Williams play, really. I mean, actor, performance, character, all belong in a Tennessee Williams play. And we wrap up the scene with the brilliant, in that case, Frederick, you're dining with a psychopathic murderer.
And clink the glasses. Yes.
I mean, Hannibal cannot resist telling everybody, I'm a killer. You're probably eating people.
Yeah. Right now.
He's hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. Because if he was a killer, why would he say any of that?
And then that reminds me of the conversation he has with Dr. Demaurier about he's being as honest and transparent as he can be.
Yeah.
He's just saying, this is me. But you're probably not going to believe it for a little while.
Well, as we go stampeding toward the end of the episode, let's slide on back and talk about our killer of the week.
We can't talk about this until we haven't
done that yet.
And this is an interesting one because the killer of the week isn't even fully revealed in this episode. He's a multi-episode killer, so the killer of the weeks. But we start in the river where workers are talking in their weird sort of southern but probably Canadian way. And a worker, their bodies in the river.
There's a lot of talk about beavers.
There are. Oh, they're blowing up the beaver dams
again. Oh, maybe some dead beavers.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Yes.
And really, there's nothing more to say about that scene other than they find some bodies in the skin.
Well, the bodies come up and they have their sort of bumbling, scary, you know, here's the comic relief moment where they're, you know, doing the freak out.
It's Laurel and Hardy as river cleaners.
Right,
moment.
Exactly.
But then we have
bodies
that
are super creepy.
Super creepy.
They are.
Very creepy. Ugh, the one where, like, the skin is coming on.
Yeah.
Very realistic, there's a lot of ick factor
in this. You know, a lot of the tableaus are beautiful. There's very little that's beautiful about this kill.
The end scene, I will say, you know, with the final reveal.
The circle.
But this lead up is, no, not at all.
When we go into the, you know, you're the new Will Graham and Hannibal arrives on the bridge with that drum beat, which is just, it's
like
methodical. Yeah, it's like, I have become. It's like Hannibal. You never got the feeling that Hannibal wanted to be Will. You just got the feeling he wanted Will to be him. But it seems like at this point we're seeing that he wanted a yin and yang thing where they're both part of each other and they're becoming one unit. And so Hannibal getting able to assume the part, which calls to mind the question, does the FBI not have experts who work for the FBI? You know, I know why they brought in Will, because he was unique.
Right.
But Hannibal's just a psychiatrist.
That's true.
So why does he get called to the scene for a psychological profile?
No, doesn't
they have profilers for that?
Does he have to get, like, vetted by the... FBI to go do that too.
Yeah. I mean, and they are investigating him in a murder investigation at the moment.
Which is why he should not be allowed to do any crime scenes.
Right. But I'm glad he is. Because it's nice. And he gets that disgusted at the bodies thing.
Oh, yes.
But very, very curious about it. Because it's interesting.
And I like the way that they are discussing, you know, after they go through the crime scene where he, you know, then we go back into the lab.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about, or not even before then, they were actually
the plastinization, the fish thing.
They were talking. He talks about the silicone.
Yeah,
and the body's injected with silicone.
Yes, yeah. And they said that he's creating human models. And I just wanted to make a reference to the plastination of you know, bodies at Body Worlds that was created by Gunther von Hagens.
That
1977.
I went to that exhibit of that stuff, and it's amazing.
One of my favorite things ever. So yeah, I know the details of that, but there is actual science behind this particular tableau, and I just wanted to make a throw out to the IRL. version where this does happen.
IRL.
This is not made up.
Okay.
When they talk about that, these are the discards. If he's making models, I want to know why he's keeping the ones he's keeping.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a creepy killer point of view thing when the killer is stalking the guy on the subway.
Yep.
And it's intense and creepy and really feels apart from this show because we spend very little time with the killers.
Mm-hmm.
On this show, and we really haven't since Coquille with the angels.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to say you have nice skin again feels like a silence thing.
Oh yes. Yeah, that is complete.
But really, could you be creepier on a subway car than to get close and say you have nice skin?
Oh, it almost like puts his hand on the guy's hand, and everything about that is so super.
And then he pulls his hand back. Yeah,
you don't do that at all on the subway.
That is gum all the way.
Well, and leading right to the abduction in the guy's in the parking lot behind his
and
apartment,
the plastic hanging out of the trunk. The whole time I was like feeling like I was watching one of those horror movies where like, don't do it, don't do it. Don't open the trunk. It's bad.
It's a trap.
It's a trap.
I love how the camera cuts away, and then you're like, oh, good. Thank goodness they're not gonna. They're giving us that one off. And then they come back from commercial. No, I mean, you see the guy hanging behind him, but they don't show you him being killed. Mm-hmm. Instead, they show you something so much worse.
Yes, they do.
Right after the commercial break. Oh, no, we aren't going to spare you.
That's where we see heroin,
mm-hmm.
and we see sewing,
mm-hmm.
and then we see resin getting applied.
Yeah, we see a spray.
And the resin, that is... Of the creep in this episode, that is so creepy because you know that's just going to harden and then make it so impossible to move.
The part that got me, and I know I'm one of those people that like, really, this is the part where you don't believe it, but when he's being sprayed down with the resin, his eyes are open.
Yeah.
Mm.
If that were to occur in real life,
IRL,
he would be unable to see.
Mm-hmm. Because he got resin in his eyes?
Yes. He wouldn't be able to look around him the way he does at the end and even realize what's happening to him.
Sure.
He probably would be blinded by that resin.
Or his eyes would be shut and he could
and the resin would hold him closed,
Exactly. So he wouldn't be able to break that open. But it looks like he's being sprayed while his eyes are partially open. So that means that resin is getting...
Yeah.
On the surface of his eyes.
Mm.
Not good for vision.
That's one of those pay no attention to the resin in the...
Yeah. To the resin in the eyeball.
Yeah. We get the lab geeks again.
Yes.
And Zeller is excited to be good at his job and not be talking about Will Graham, I think. Because he even throws out a little China White.
Yeah.
That was very cute.
I mean, I love when... This show has the best lab techs because they are so excited about their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Beverly loves her job. And it's so wonderful to see them shine at mm-hmm. doing their jobs and be this way in the middle of other serious, intense mm-hmm. stuff. Because you have to be like that to have a job like that.
See, but I love how that in that scene you want to be like, oh, Z, this is not NCIS. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Right. We don't care. We don't think you're cool because you said China White.
Yeah. That's it's kind true. Of a dated reference.
We think you're cool for other reasons.
Well, you're fun. You're fun. But this is still the Will Graham show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And you just contributed to him being in jail.
Spoiler alert, but...
So they really, I mean, these scenes are entirely expository, mm-hmm. you know, and it's something that they tend to do when we go to the Killer of the Week, because the Killer of the Week has so much stuff that they need to get across that here's a lot of information, and how is he doing this? I don't know. We have about 10 minutes in this episode to have a full CSI episode. And Beverly knows they can't solve it alone, and her intense expression says that. So immediately she goes to Will Graham with the most beautiful DMV pictures art director could have ever created for a show.
She was laying them all out, and it was sort of like, these are the nicest looking pictures I've ever seen.
But how nice was that to see Will really excited to see Beverly, mm-hmm. and excited thinking... maybe she came to visit with me.
Mm-hmm. And then...
And so disappointed to realize it's just business.
Yeah. He cannot escape being used for his abilities, even when he's been locked up in prison.
Yeah. Mm. The rearrangement of the photos was a cool moment, too.
Yeah.
When Will is just looking at them and then picks up that stack and sort of looks over and, well, what if these go over here?
Mm-hmm.
And then as he's assembling it and learning what he's doing as he's doing it,
mm-hmm.
that was really cool and a really nice little moment. It got me over the hoariness of the, you want to know how he's choosing them, don't you?
Don't you?
It's like,
which is a reference, again,
to Silence of the Lambs.
Silence. Yeah. What I liked about there, too, is in this scene, Beverly lays them out and says, tell me what you see.
See, yeah. It's almost like they're tarot cards.
Yeah. Oh, it is, yeah.
It reminds me of the Garrett Jacob Hobbs scene, see, and then the reenactment where Will is Garrett Jacob Hobbs, see.
Well, because nobody's listening to what Will actually sees.
Mm. Tell me what you see. It's just like that chill. I got a chill when I heard to say it.
And then what's the last image of the episode?
Oh, yes. What did you see in that?
In
Miko. Because I know what it is. Because I've seen the next episode. So, the tableau.
Uh-huh.
What is the tableau to you?
Oh, okay.
What is the tableau?
What is the tableau? The last image of the episode.
Well, I saw the last image of the episode. And there is a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is.
It's an eye.
Wow. I didn't even realize that.
White in the iris.
Yeah, uh-huh. And it goes from lighter to darker around the edges.
Because I didn't even... Because I know it was that whole thing of it's a palette. Mm. So I didn't... I knew he was specifically making something
mm-hmm.
with these different colors. I didn't realize it was an eye.
It's all about seeing.
Mm.
See.
Just like Garrett Jacob Hobbs has been imploring us to do. Since the first episode.
I was like, I don't want to give my opinion because I already know. I should let Miko, who's fresh, know.
How did I not see that? I've looked at it twice, and it didn't even occur to me.
So let's go back to a nice Winston scene. Because I feel like every episode could use two or more
Winston scenes.
And, thank you, buddy, for making your presence known when we're talking about the dog. So Jack goes to Will's house and finds Winston.
Yes.
Winston comes to the door while Jack is there. Why does Will sleep in the living room of a pretty big house? Why is his bed in the living room?
Because he sleeps by the dogs. There's a lot
of
them.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So he needs a big room.
Yeah.
What does he do with the rest of his house, do you suppose?
Well, he clearly doesn't have people over.
He's got his antler room.
I mean, seems like a relatively minimalistic type of person.
Yeah.
He does. He keeps his flies right next to the door on the table.
Yes.
He's got the piano there. But I mean,
really, he does have a piano.
I think he wanted a house that was in the middle of nowhere. And it was the right price. And so he doesn't really care.
He may not even have decorated the upstairs.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I would imagine, at least.
Mm. Okay, so back to Winston, because that's the most important part here. Lana arrives and finds Jack just sitting there playing with Winston, talking to Winston, engaging, because people are pretty angry with Jack in general, at this moment. And I like the idea that they're all looking for Will. Winston is looking for Will, so are they.
To be music nerd, when Winston shows
up, the music nerd,
we get the first chord of the Will's Happy Place music.
Yes.
But just the first chord. You don't get the whole theme.
We don't deserve it at this point in the episode.
Well, because it's intrinsically tied to Winston, because it first came in when he found Winston. But I like that. It was this little happy chord. We like Winston.
We love Winston.
Yes, we do.
And they bring up the line that declaring Hannibal's guilt is more important than preparing his defense, which brings up the question of why is that more important than preparing his offense? Maybe he doesn't feel that he has anything to defend against. You know, if you really think about it, if we're really trying to prove this and not worried at all about what'll happen when the trial comes, guilty people tend to worry about how I'm going to get off from when the trial comes.
That's true.
Especially since nobody is on board with the whole Hannibal did it, except for Will.
Yeah.
I like that later, tying it in with Jack, when Jack shows up in Will's Mayan Palace, I like that
Will's fishing and Jack's on the bank.
But he's his face, it's like not like he's smiling or anything, but it seems like he's welcome there.
Yeah.
Not like maybe the stag and certainly not like the Wendigo. So I like that contrast. I like that even with everything going on, Jack fits with that surrounding. Even just the brown of his coat fits with that surrounding in a way that the other images don't.
Like the black Wendigo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
when he comes out of his memory palace, he sees Jack and greets him like a friend you're surprised to see, rather than like the guy who put him in jail. Mm-hmm. And says, memories are all I have.
Which, from silence.
Imagine how nice it is to stumble on a new one. Will is playing this great little verbal sparring game here, and he's gleeful because he's figured out that he didn't do it. And what a great thing, because he was actually afraid he did. Mm-hmm. And now that he knows this, now he knows all my energy can be devoted towards proving the psychopath, the monster that walks among us, is the monster.
Is the monster. I am being manipulated.
Because Jack talks about how meaningless his memories are, and they really are meaningless from a legal point of view. Mm-hmm. But to Will, they're the most important thing in the world.
Right.
And his version of memories are all I have is very different than Hannibal Lecter's version in Silence of the Lambs. Mm-hmm. Because Hannibal Lecter's is, I don't have the world, I have my memories.
Right.
Will's are, I have these memories and they are what is valuable to me because they tell me who I am.
Or what happened and how I can
that too.
Convince the world.
The accusatory, you let the fox in the hen house.
Oh, I loved that line. Yeah.
Because
wonderful.
Alana and then Jack invited Hannibal to consult on this thing with poor, poor, unstable Will. And then we leave it with, you may not believe me now, but you will.
But you will.
But you
will. As Jack is walking away, and Jack's playing his standard tough guy, I don't want to listen to this. I don't want to listen to this. Yeah. You're going to talk about this, I'm going to go.
I'm going to just cut you off and go.
Do you remember the last time it comes, that I remember, you will on the show? Mm. I don't find you that interesting.
Oh, yes.
You will.
That's from the pilot? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the, and that was all over the commercials for Hannibal, too. Mm-hmm. I don't find you that interesting. Yeah. And poor Hannibal, alone in his office. waiting for Will.
Staring at the empty chair.
Who will never come. Because you put him in jail.
Right. And she's waiting almost like Winston.
Like Winston. Just like Winston.
I would need to watch it again, because this only occurred to me the most recent time. It's like the fourth or fifth time I've seen this episode.
Nice.
I feel like the scoring there is pentatonic. I could be wrong, but it certainly sounded different to me than the rest of the scoring in the episode. And if it is pentatonic scoring, that would fit in with the theme of the season, with being the Kaiski. I hope that's vaguely close to saying it right. It being more...
You pronounce pentatonic.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's, I don't even know if I pronounced that pentatonic right.
No, but that's... Greek roots, that one's way easier. But that would tie in with the East Asian influence on the season. So I thought that was interesting. There's also, if with that kind of scoring, since to Western ears at least, there's a lot more space. You hear there's a lot more emptiness between the notes, which would fit with Hannibal. But again, that's giant asterisk, caveated. I need to watch it again, but that's what came to mind.
That point is very interesting, because I was listening to we were watching the documentary where they were talking with the editors from the episode and how they intentionally produce a cut that's much longer. They produce like a 46-minute cut, and episodes are about 41 and a half. And then they cut it down to... They cut it down more than they need to, and then they add space in. Okay. Between lines of dialogue. So unlike most TV where it's about the rapid back and forth,
and
because we only have a limited amount of time, they cut more dialogue out than they need to so they can add the pauses in, which is like the space between notes, which is very cool.
There you go.
One of the best moments in that fight, too. The pause.
Yeah.
The
pause.
Yes.
And with Bedelia as well. And with the lecture with Katie, where there's that just kind of awkward pause. Yeah. The line's like, what'd you think? And the line's like squirming or see a little bit.
I don't know.
So yes, excellent use of pauses.
And then we're at the big reveal of the tableau. Yeah. Where we counted and got a few different numbers, but it's more than 30
more
bodies.
More than 30.
I'm going to say approximately 30 plus. At least 30.
So you're gonna take my more than 30 and you're gonna turn it into approximately 30 plus?
Well,
I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, we are saying the same thing. I'm sorry. Yes, we are.
So our victim awakens to the horrifying realization that he has been sewn to his hand, his legs have been sewn together, and he's been thrown in a pile of bodies.
Yes.
Well, not thrown. He's been sutured in.
He's been sutured to himself, but has he been sewn to the others?
He was sutured to the others.
The body next to him, yes. Definitely adding to the horror.
Man, the horror indeed. Mm-hmm. So that's our first big tableau of the season. Did I not promise bigger and more fascinating tableaus?
You did. Because I said I didn't want that to go away. Then even though we're doing less...
Even though we wanted to get rid of the killer of the week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just... The tableaus are fascinating to me. And I've said this before. It's this whole idea of... Someone had to sit down and come up with this. You know, this is not something that they're taking from reality. There has been no tableau in the shape of an eye found, you know, somewhere in the United States, and we just don't know about it, you know.
I think we know about that.
I'm just thinking about the solve rates for crimes.
That's been found that we know about. Mm-hmm. Found.
It's been...
That has so far been...
So what she's saying is there probably is a giant eye-shaped tableau somewhere.
Somewhere.
I'm just saying I wouldn't discount the possibility.
But that it could be. Yeah, so... But it's just... okay, so there is a chance that this, you know, could happen. But let's just say the person who's coming up with this is not, like, looking up serial killers on Wikipedia and going... Oh, I'm going to do that one, because that sounds kind of cool.
This is an original idea.
Yeah, they have to sit there and come up with the fungi and the all the different... How do you sit there and go, oh, okay, what he's going to do is cover them in resin and fill them up with silicone. And, it's such an interesting way of killing somebody that's so it's so time consuming
and torturous.
Methodical and torturous. Exactly.
With the heroin introduction, yeah. That is just.
I find it so fascinating that they can come up with these.
It's got to be a very enjoyable writer's room.
Oh, very much so. And I enjoy seeing the creativity of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it kind of gets me through, you know, yes, we have sort of not really a methodical storyline, but we're following something that pretty much has, like, a logical conclusion. It's dialogue, it's tension, it's reveal. It's, you know, it's, and then all of a sudden in the middle you have this, like, beautiful, grotesque sort of thing happening at the same time. And I like
a chair made out of antlers.
Like a chair, man. Exactly.
Oh, my goodness, that throwback.
Yes. But I love it. I love the creativity. I love sitting there and going, wow, this is brilliant and messed up all at the same time. And it gives me something to really look forward to. Not that I'm not interested in the story, but it's sort of like a wonderful little gift in every storyline that we get to do this fun little thing.
Wonderful little horrible gift.
Horrible gift. Wrapped up in frightening little bows like a Tim Burton gift.
Black wrapping paper, black bow.
Exactly.
So, Kate, where can they find you?
Well, this has been so much fun. because I listen to the podcast as well, so I'm going to enjoy following you guys through on your journey through season two.
Oh, it's so wonderful, season two.
Never mind. I'm not going to enjoy spoiler. A couple scenes.
Yeah, well,
I can't say when they're going to happen.
No spoilers.
But anyways, but I will enjoy listening to your guys' thoughts on them. This has been a lot of fun. But you can, listeners can find me on Twitter at The Televerse. The Televerse is the name of the TV podcast that I do. Ophelia was just on. It was wonderful.
She was.
Thank you.
We cover...
It's a pleasure.
TV.
The breadth of television.
A lot
of it.
A lot.
Especially right now with premieres. We're covering about 20 shows a week right now. But that's at soundinsight.org, where I'm the TV editor. You can also find some of my reviews up at the AV Club, where I contribute, and really just the best place, hit me up on Twitter, because I just love talking to all y'all. And if you're listening to a Hannibal podcast, then I want to talk to you. So at the
there's so few of us, so let's all just talk.
Yeah, really, let's
Hannibals unite.
Yes. This was not enough discussion of the season two premiere for you, which I don't know how that would be possible, but knowing myself and the way that I listen to podcasts, I know that some of you are out there. This Is Our Design is the podcast just about Hannibal that I do over at Sound On Sight. And if you want to go back and listen to more about season one, those episodes will be coming out. The end of the season will be coming out in the next few weeks. So we would love to have you check that out as well.
So, Kate, will you come and join us again?
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe we should have you back for the finale.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
I've already talked about it for, like, almost 3 hours, but I think I have another three in me.
We will make that so. We will make that so. Okay, you can contact us at contact@eattherootcast.com. You can follow us on Tumblr at eattherootcast.tumblr.com or on Twitter at eattherootcast. Thank you for joining us at the table.
It's happening again. That gum we like is finally coming back in style, and Twin Peaks is returning to television in 2016. In celebration, we, the hosts of Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about NBC's Hannibal, will turn our attention to a town called Twin Peaks, where we will revisit all 29 episodes of the original series, as well as Fire Walk with Me, all leading up to weekly podcasts about brand new episodes of Twin Peaks on Showtime in 2016. We hope you'll join us for a damn good podcast.